You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. As you're getting your tax stuff together to file your returns in the weeks and months ahead, brace yourself for a potentially frustrating experience with the IRS. According to a new report from a government watchdog called the National Taxpayer Advocate, the Internal Revenue Service is, quote, in crisis. That's based on a tough 2021 for many filers. For one thing, it took an exceptionally long time for the IRS to process returns, issue refunds, and address questions. In fact, the report mentions that Americans visited the IRS website 630 million times to check on the status of their refunds. It's a 70% jump over the year before the pandemic. Here's a line from the report, quote, there is no way to sugarcoat the year 2021 in tax administration. From the perspective of tens of millions of taxpayers, it was horrendous. It goes on, 2021 was the most challenging year ever for taxpayers, end quote. The Treasury Department said this year probably won't be too much better. On the other hand, IRS officials and some lawmakers are defending the agency's record. They point to the successful payout of stimulus checks and the expanded child tax credit in the middle of the pandemic after years of budget and staffing cuts at the agency. You can start filing your 2021 returns later this month. Deadline is April 18th. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your tax filing experience last year. Were you one of the people who ran into trouble getting your return processed, getting your refund when you were hoping to get it? Or did things go smoothly for you? If so, what did you do that made it go well? What was it like trying to get info from the IRS? If you're a tax preparer, what kind of things were you seeing? What kind of advice do you have for tax filers? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Heather Long is an economics columnist for The Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, good to be here. Wish I had better news.
Yeah, so talking about this watchdog report, words like horrendous, frustrating, in crisis, you don't want to see that. Can you talk a little more about what they had to say about what taxpayers could expect this year?
Yeah, I mean, I covered a lot of this last year for the Washington Post, and it's just crazy to think that this filing season could potentially be even worse. I'm sure many callers will have horror stories from the experience last year. Only about 11% of phone calls were answered. If, heaven forbid, you got one of those notices in the mail, over 11 million people received a notice indicating the IRS thought that you had a math error. It would take close to 200 days to sort that out, so more than double what it normally takes when there's some sort of, you know, you think your tax return should say one thing and the IRS thinks it should say another, and you're trying to figure that out. But the bottom line takeaway here from this National Taxpayer Advocate and from any of us who've lived through that tax filing season last year is, right or wrong, there was a real push to cut the IRS funding for years, specifically from about 2010 to 2020. There was a real gutting of the IRS budget. It's down about 20%. And they've had to basically cut staff about 20%. That's why you can't get anybody on the phone. That's why it takes forever now if you have to send in a paper return to get it processed. There just simply aren't enough people there right now. And there's been a little bit of an increase in funding, but not much. So that's why they're warning that they're using terms like this tax season will be just as frustrating and expect enormous challenges. If you remember nothing else from the segment, I keep telling people file in February. Technically, the season opens January 24th, but last year there were a lot of glitches on the first few days. So your best bet is let those glitches go the first few days and file in February.
And maybe another piece of advice is if you tend to build your finances around getting that refund, maybe don't do that so much now, knowing that it could be later than you expect.
Yeah, and it was particularly bad last year. I'm sure some callers may bring this up. Unfortunately, for a lot of people who really needed it, so anyone who had unemployment money that they had received during the pandemic, or they were trying to get the expanded earned income tax credit or the expanded child tax credit, those are the people who tended to have their tax return basically held up, their refund delayed, because their 1040, their tax return was sent for extra scrutiny, basically.
Well, you just needed
a manual review, which is going to take, since there's not a lot of people, it's going to take even longer. So
you just heard it from Heather. She wants to hear from you if you have a difficult tax story from last year. Were you one of the people refreshing that IRS website again and again, trying to get through on phone lines? Did you wait longer than expected to get your return processed or your refund? Do you have questions about what's going on this year? Some of the causes behind these problems? You can join in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tax professionals who help other people prepare. You've probably seen a lot. What kind of things did you go through last year? What are you gearing up for this year? Do you now or have you ever worked for the IRS? Love to hear your perspective as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Heather Long with us from the Washington Post, looking at the challenges facing IRS. Let's get into some more of the causes of the problems last year, Heather. You mentioned really low staffing cuts. On top of that, the IRS got asked in these COVID relief packages to do a lot more stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, everyone was also eagerly awaiting their stimulus payments last year, which were trying to go out about the same time that they were trying to run the normal tax filing season. And, you know, the good news is they did get the stimulus payments out in a fairly timely manner. The bad news is they diverted a lot, what few resources and people they had left to work on those stimulus payments. And so they weren't working on tax returns. You may recall last year, they actually extended the tax filing deadline to July 15th because they were running so far behind. By about April, May, they were 35 million backlog of tax returns that were unprocessed, which is just an unprecedented number. Normally, they get a couple million backlogged, but they're able to get through it pretty quickly in April and May, and they just didn't. They still, even in December, it wouldn't surprise me if we have a caller right now who says, I still haven't had my tax return processed. There's still 6 million unprocessed tax returns last year, another 2 million amended tax returns. When you send an amended, you generally have to send it in paper. So, of course, those are delayed. So we're already starting this new tax filing season with a big backlog from last year.
Yeah. Is that part of the problem here, that they're still playing catch up?
Yeah, they're still playing catch up. It should be a little easier. Obviously, we're not expecting them to send out more stimulus checks this time around unless the economy really tanks and Congress takes action. But again, they're still having to implement. They had to implement that new expanded child tax credit, which started to send out those payments every month from July through December. Well, a lot of people are going to be submitting tax returns to get the rest of that money that they didn't get last year. And so, so there's just been a lot of changes to the tax code. It's become a lot more complicated with a goal of helping people. But these systems, unfortunately, that they're running on, in many cases, are still COBOL. You know, these are still systems from sort of the 60s and 70s computer programs. And, you just sort of put all this together. Fewer people, ancient computers, more stuff to do. And it doesn't take an MBA from Harvard to figure out this is going to be a mess.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Oshkosh. John, hello.
Hi.
What'd you go through last year, John?
Say that again?
What happened to you with your taxes last year, John?
Oh, sorry. So last year I had a large return because I put in a solar system, and the rest of my taxes was very, very simple. And so months after I expected to get paid, it would show up in processing. So I finally started trying to do the phone call in, and I could never get through. So finally, I decided to call the IRS and push the numbers in for saying I owed them money. And when you owe them money, they seem to answer a lot quicker. So I finally was able to talk to somebody, and then they looked at my account and they're like, well, you're in the wrong area. And I'm like, I know. And I explained to them why I picked them instead of going the normal route. They routed me to the right place. And within a couple of days, it was finally fixed.
Okay, well, a happy ending, John. Thanks for sharing that story. But, Heather, it clearly took some doing.
Yeah, I mean, I chuckled as he was telling that story. Very clever of John to figure that out. A lot of people also ended up getting routed to the National Taxpayer Advocate, which is supposed to be the helpline, basically, for people who are having these problems and aren't able to get through to the IRS. But, you know, the Taxpayer Advocate Office has also seen close to a tenfold increase in people calling them. So, you know, I think John was pretty clever there, but it shouldn't, that's not what it should take in order to get a response from the IRS in a timely manner.
John, thanks for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. Therese joins us now in Stevens Point. Therese, hi. Oh,
hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a somewhat unique but extremely frustrating situation with the IRS. I'm the trustee for my late father's trust. We filed his 2019 tax return a month prior to his death, which was August 2020, and we're still waiting for the federal tax refund. We received the state, but not the federal. And I've been trying every few months to call the IRS, have been put on hold. When I finally get through to an agent, all they can tell me is there's a hold on it, because apparently the IRS thinks that we made a mistake on a Schedule A medical expense. I've written them letters saying we're not going to dispute the error. We would just like the refund. We're trying to close up the estate. I've reached out to my congressman's office. They have a taxpayer advocate working on it. The last time I called, which was about a week ago, they could give me no information on the status of it other than it still had a hold on it. And they were going to put in a referral into the system and I should hear back in 60 days. So it's been an extremely frustrating year and a half trying late father's refund.
Well, Therese, I'm so sorry to hear that. On top, of course, of the loss of your father and having to deal with this for a year and a half now. Heather, but it sounds like, unfortunately, the more unique your tax case or situation is, the more difficult, the longer it might take to deal with it.
Yeah, particularly if it involves anything in the mail, the snail mail, if you will. You know, Therese has done all the right things by contacting her her congressperson and getting the National Taxpayer Advocate involved. Obviously, being able to get through on the phone, calling now before tax season starts is smart. You know, but the sad truth is we were reading some of the backlog statistics earlier. There's also 5 million unopened pieces of mail that are still waiting to be processed. So it wouldn't surprise me if Therese's letter is unfortunately one of those 5 million pieces of mail that are just sitting in a mailbag waiting to be processed.
Well, Therese, best to you and your family getting that resolved, hopefully sooner than later. We are talking about challenges facing the IRS last year, this year, what it means for taxpayers during the upcoming filing season. Heather Long is with us, economics columnist for The Washington Post, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a story to share about difficulties getting your taxes processed, returns done, refunds mailed out to you or transferred to your account last year, questions about what to expect this year. If things went smoothly for you, love to hear that too. And if you help people file their taxes, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. A new report from the National Taxpayer Advocate, that's a government watchdog, describes the IRS as being in crisis, comes after a 2021 marked with long delays to process tax returns, issue refunds, address other concerns, difficulty answering the phones even. The report blames in part the pandemic, years of severe budget cuts, and added responsibilities. Was this a story about you last year? 800-642-1234 is the number to call to share if you had difficulties getting taxes filed, processed, refunds made, complicated, simple problems that took a long time. Were you on hold or not able to get through? Or did you have a problem that did get resolved? Share that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Heather, we've been talking about staffing shortages at the IRS and funding cuts over the last bunch of years. Is there any help on the way? Are they able to bring in more staff to help do some of these things we're talking about?
That's the hope. I mean, honestly, the IRS commissioners, the past ones, both Republican and Democrat, have really been trying to raise the alarm here that this is crazy and they need more funding and more staff. But I guess the short answer is there's no immediate relief on the horizon. The Congress did not approve, you know, a huge boost in funding for the IRS for this year, unfortunately. And even if miraculously tomorrow, let's say Republicans and Democrats came together and passed more money for the IRS, you know, these are sensitive. This is a really sensitive job. You're working with people's Social Security numbers. You're working with people's finances. And so it does require a lot of training and a lot of background checks in order to get people into these jobs, particularly like what the situation that John and Therese, the prior callers, were just sharing, when there's something that's a little bit more complicated, you know, you need someone with an accounting background or with more of a some deeper knowledge to do this job. So President Biden has called for more IRS funding. He's put it in the part of the Build Back Better plan, but this isn't going to be fixed in time for this tax filing season.
What are some of the politics behind not wanting to fund the IRS? I mean, I guess it's not necessarily the most popular agency out there for people's experience with it. Does that drive a unwillingness to add more funding to it?
Unfortunately, it does. And they're, you know, right or wrong, I think Republicans, when they were looking to for ways to get the budget under control in the 2010, 2011, 2012 period, unfortunately did really gut the IRS. I think there's some regret about that now. There are certainly parts of government that could probably use a little bit of pruning, but I think we've all learned that the IRS is you can prune too much. And at the same time, right or wrong, Congress, and this is both parties, Republicans and Democrats, both approved an expansion of the IRS purview. So using the IRS to send out those stimulus checks, or using the IRS to do those child tax credit, the expanded child tax credit payments. And the IRS, you know, has generally done a good job. They got the money out much faster than the Small Business Administration during the crisis, for example. But you can only do so much. I just want to read one more stat that really hit home to me. Two quick ones here. The current staff at the IRS is similar to the level in the 1970s. Obviously, our population is a lot bigger than the 1970s. And the other one that should really make your eyes bulge is we have the smallest number of auditors at the IRS since World War II. So if you're wondering, gee, you know, I'm a middle-class American like John or Therese, why can't my problem get handled? Well, the number of auditors is very small, and unfortunately, a lot of very wealthy people who probably should have their accounts scrutinized more instead of middle-class people are not being scrutinized right now.
I had a caller couldn't stay on the line, Heather, who says, you know, my forms, they were self-employed, I think, but the 1040 forms seem to keep getting more complicated, harder for the individual to fill out in the first place. And maybe that means more difficult for the IRS to process and audit. Is there something to that?
It's interesting the caller made that point. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to speak to them, because I have to say the Republicans deserve some credit as part of their 2017 tax overhaul reform. They did simplify the 1040, so it actually got shorter. Those people who have been filling out tax returns for many years, I raised my hand as one of them, will remember that the 1040 used to be two full pages. Now it's about a page and a half. So it actually has gotten a little bit easier in the past few years. I will say the pandemic was really complicated for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people's incomes changed when they lost jobs, and you had these unemployment payments, which were supposed to be taxed, but a lot of states didn't withhold the federal taxes on that. So I think when he talks about it being really complicated last year and this year, it's probably more a result of the pandemic than the actual form itself.
Now, I know you're not a tax advisor, Heather, but from what you've seen in your reporting and your colleagues' reporting, are there things that people can do that can help make things go more smoothly, raise the chances that their stuff is going to get processed, refunds issued sooner?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty basic, but definitely file online. About 10% of people still file by mail. And if you can avoid, I mean, obviously, we've got millions of unprocessed mail right now from last year. You don't want to be part of that backlog. Do the e-file if you can. I said it early in the show, my mantra is file in February if you can. The tax season opens January 24th, but usually, sometimes there's glitches, and we saw this at the start of the filing season last year, where a bunch of people who filed like on the day of or right around then actually had their returns sent for manual review because some of those quirks in the system weren't worked out yet. So that's why I'm like, give it a week, let somebody else test the system. If you file in February, you should be at the, at the earlier end of the processing and hopefully get a return, by March if you do that.
And just our
Okay.
last less than a minute now, Heather, the IRS says they're getting slammed. This taxpayer watchdog said they're overwhelmed. Is there a sense that, okay, we may not be able to fix things in time for this year, but we, the federal government, got to do something here?
I mean, again, I will say the Build Back Better plan did include a huge amount of additional funding for the IRS with the goal of being able to fix a lot of these problems. But obviously, it's looking pretty bleak for that bill to pass. So I really, really hope there'll be some bipartisan effort on this. But obviously, with the midterms coming up in 2022, it's just hard to see any action on this year, sadly.
Heather, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Heather Long, economics columnist at the Washington Post. We talked to her about a new government watchdog report that says the IRS is in crisis. The Treasury Department said the upcoming tax filing season could be frustrating for millions of taxpayers. Millions of Americans are at higher risk for severe disease or death from COVID-19. That includes people with underlying health conditions like obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, older people, and people with intellectual disabilities, who research has shown are six times more likely to die from COVID-19. Most states don't have mask mandates in place, raising concerns that people who are at risk will be even more vulnerable. The Americans with Disabilities Act mandates that public spaces, jobs, and schools be accessible to people with chronic illnesses and disabilities. Some lawsuits have been filed arguing that this 1990 law should apply during the pandemic to decisions that could put people with disabilities at a higher risk. We're talking about the intersection of disability, the law, and the pandemic, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one have a disability or chronic condition that puts you at higher risk for severe disease or death from COVID-19? Do you want to see places like your local school or workplaces require masks? What are your thoughts on the Supreme Court overturning the Biden administration's workplace vaccine mandate? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Professor Peter Blank is a university professor and chairman of the Burton Blatt Institute at the Syracuse University College of Law. He's an expert on disability law and co-author of the treatise Disability, Civil Rights, Law, and Policy, which explores the legacy of the Americans with Disabilities Act and cases that came following the passage of the law in 1990. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you. Delighted to say hi to all my friends in Wisconsin. Spent many years there.
Well, welcome back then. Well, before we get into the Americans with Disabilities Act, as it relates to COVID, can you give us a quick reminder, a quick overview of the kind of protections and guarantees that come with the ADA?
Well, at the highest level, if there was one examination at the end of a law school 3 years that could cover every single aspect almost of the law, from constitutional law to administrative law to health law, you name it, they would be well suited to ask a question about what we're talking about today. And the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is one piece of this very complex social, cultural, and economic question during this emergency, which relates to the ways in which people with disabilities can be equally included in society. And the ADA, in a nutshell, is a very comprehensive law. It's one of the most comprehensive in the world. It was passed in 1990, and it covers employment, it covers educational issues, it covers state and local government operations. It covers private entities like hotels and businesses and restaurants. So it's quite a comprehensive law. And at the end of the day, if you are deemed covered, we can talk about that, as a person by the law, as a person with a disability for purposes of the ADA, then you have protections with regard to not only anti-discrimination in these areas, but the affirmative obligation to provide what's called reasonable accommodations or changes to the way things are done that don't create a hardship for the entity, but still allow people with disabilities to participate equally.
Let's dive in now to some of the ADA issues that have come up during COVID-19. Here's one of them. Last year, parents in 9 states sued over mask mandate bans in their school districts. So states, in many cases, said schools can't issue mask mandates. The parents here say, you know, banning these mandates discriminated against their kids with disabilities and chronic conditions who are at higher risk. In effect, saying, without masks present, our kids are at higher risk. They don't have an equal opportunity, an equal platform in these schools. Can you talk about how the ADA does, and I guess doesn't, apply here?
Well, this is being fought out in courts across the country with different results. There's a case in Texas right now that's dealing with some of these very same issues. In a nutshell, again, to what extent is it discriminatory and exclusive if your child cannot attend public school because they have asthma, a chronic health condition, immunosensitivity, pick your condition. And if masks are not used in the classroom, then they are super susceptible to getting sick. And therefore, any reasonable parent would not send them to school. So the question is, can a state, and a school district would be a state entity, either enforce or not enforce such mandates? And to what extent would they exclude children who otherwise should and would be able to go to school with some form of accommodation? And the courts have been mixed on this question. As you said, in Florida and elsewhere, the state governments have opposed these mask mandates. 9 states, I believe, require most people, California, Hawaii, New Mexico, I don't believe Wisconsin is one of those,
correct,
that have a mask mandate mostly indoors. But a lot of the, in the school districts, there's a lot of debate and issue about whether these should be enforced. For example, people might say under the Constitution of the United States, that if their children are forced to wear a mask, this could conceivably influence their freedom of speech, their freedom of religion, and other civil rights they might have under the Bill of Rights.
Talking to Syracuse University law professor Peter Blank about the Americans with Disabilities Act and COVID-19 regulations, mask mandates, the absence of mask mandates, and vaccination requirements we'll get into. You could join in with your maybe experiences, maybe as a person with a chronic condition or a disability. Do you feel limited in what you can do based on Wisconsin's current status of no mask mandates, no vaccine requirements? Or do you worry that it's an imposition, maybe even discrimination against some people to require vaccinations or masks? Do you have a question about how this all works in the law? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, there's also been talk about discrimination related to vaccination, or I guess in this case, unvaccinated status. One bill currently in the Wisconsin legislature would ban schools from discriminating against students based on vaccine status. Now, this would be a state law. I don't think this is invoking the Americans with Disabilities Act in any way. Is there a claim from someone under the ADA who says, yeah, my workplace can't make me be vaccinated? I would view it as discriminatory against me under the ADA.
Well, yes, it could be discriminatory, hypothetically, if for some religious or medical reasons, the person could not take the vaccine or wear the mask. As a matter of fact, those are the types of cases that are percolating through the courts. So the ADA has been interestingly applied by both opponents and proponents of these mandates and these vaccination requirements. The historical basis for this goes back to about 1905, when the Supreme Court decided a case called Jacobson v. Massachusetts. And in that case, an individual, Mr. Jacobson, opposed being vaccinated for smallpox, as was required of adults in Massachusetts over age 21. In fact, he had had a bad experience with a smallpox vaccination type opportunity or experience when he was in Sweden, and he didn't want to repeat that. The Supreme Court held, basically, that while you're always weighing competing interests, in this case, it was a legitimate purpose of the state to care for the public health and safety, and therefore to enforce the vaccination requirement. Now, the United States Supreme Court, of course, has come out differently depending upon the nature of the employee, if it's a federal employee or a state employee, the nature of the business, if it receives federal funds or if it's a private business. But there really is no definitive answer yet as a legal matter with regard to some of the issues you're talking about.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joshua is with us in Madison. Joshua, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I had a question for Peter.
Go for it.
So my question, Peter, is most accommodations, at least in my imagination, are not burdens on each and every employee in the workplace. So a reasonable accommodation might be a ramp or additional parking. So isn't the idea of masks as a reasonable accommodation different because it burdens each and every employee rather than, say, the employer as a whole?
Interesting question, Joshua. Yeah.
That's a brilliant question that many of us have been thinking about, Joshua. And to put it in a complimentary way, when you think of an accommodation, it's typically for the particular individual, say, to wear a mask in an environment because he or she might be susceptible to a medical injury. But now this is kind of flipped so that in order for that individual to be protected, everybody must wear a mask as a reasonable accommodation. And I would say that there are precedents for that in this area. Now, a reasonable accommodation, as you said, Joshua, cannot dramatically disrupt the nature of the business financially or programmatically. And the individual cannot necessarily pose a health threat to others in the workplace. So there are limits on this concept of reasonable accommodation. But you raise a very good point, which is also unsettled. To what extent must others in that environment affirmatively change their behavior so that they can accommodate the person who is susceptible with a disability? And there are examples of that. For example, regular health requirements in the workplace and other sorts of changes in workplace safety and other sorts of issues. But it is a complicated question, particularly when that individual's accommodation may affect literally tens, hundreds of other people in the way they engage in the workplace. Very good question, Joshua.
Thanks for calling in, Joshua. Peter Blank is a university professor and chair of the Burton Blatt Institute at the Syracuse University College of Law. He's talking to us now about disability rights during the pandemic and the Americans with Disabilities Act. You could join in with your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you have a disability or a health condition that makes you high risk when it comes to COVID? What has your experience of the pandemic looked like? Do you think that not having things like mask mandates could violate your protections under the Americans with Disabilities Act? Or in general, do you have questions about how this all works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about disability rights and the pandemic. The U.S. Supreme Court overturned President Biden's vaccine or test mandate for businesses, saying the federal government is overstepping its bounds. We're looking at vaccination requirements, mask requirements. There are lawsuits aplenty out there. We're talking to Syracuse University law professor and disability law expert Peter Blank about how the law protects and does not protect people with disabilities or chronic conditions during the pandemic. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Susan is with us in Coon Valley. Susan, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Susan?
Hello. I'm curious, you know, those of us that have disabilities, we try to protect ourselves and we go into certain environments, whether it be Walmart or grocery stores or sports activities, where people are not wearing masks. So what about empowering us to say, okay, we're going to start lawsuits against these places that are not enforcing or requiring people to wear masks? I mean, we're at a disadvantage here, and I think maybe we need to start empowering ourselves and saying, okay, we're going to start lawsuits. What do you think?
Peter, what do you think?
It's a very good question and comment, Susan. I should say, as you well know, Susan, number one, the disability community is not at all monolithic on these issues. Disability for all of us who are touched in different ways is just a natural part of what we're experiencing in life. And so people might disagree even within the disability community. But Susan, now you're talking about another area of the law, which is quite interesting. I'm not aware of such lawsuits, and that is basically negligence and that of reasonable care. If somebody with a disability and a susceptibility were to go into a hotel or someplace else or a restaurant, and in fact, they were not diligent, reasonably, to protect that individual who may or may not choose to wear a mask, then there is potential for the type of litigation you're talking about. It's less available under the Americans with Disabilities Act and more available under traditional what's called tort or injury litigation.
Susan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Peter, something I saw in the news today, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to take up a challenge to a federal mask mandate on public transportation. I got to wear a mask when I get on the bus to come to work in the morning. You have to wear one on airplanes. And there was a challenge from a citizen who said, me and my kid, we can't wear a mask for long periods of time. The U.S. Supreme Court saying we're not going to take that up. So that one stands. Do you see other potential avenues for somebody to challenge that federal transportation mask mandate under the ADA?
Well, that's very interesting. I actually hadn't seen that yet. But, this issue really goes to the nature of society as a whole and group interests versus individual rights. And it even, it, of course, transcends the law, the dialogue we're having here now. And I haven't seen that decision. Maybe there's a dissent by the justices who I would expect to dissent. But the federal government, through its Department of Transportation, certainly has the authority to promulgate such requirements. Obviously, they were challenged, and the Supreme Court chose not to take it up. Depending upon the composition of the court, and I don't mean to oversimplify it, but certainly it could have come out differently. And so it's a very interesting time in the law because of this terrific social, cultural, political overlay, which is in large part driving these outcomes. Now, why did the Supreme Court not take this up? I'd have to look at the decision. Am I surprised? Not particularly, given the nature of the makeup of the court and the focus on individual rights, religious rights, speech rights, all of which could be potentially implicated by such a requirement.
We're talking to Syracuse University law professor Peter Blank about the Americans with Disabilities Act, disability protections, and requirements, mandates for masks and vaccines during this COVID-19 pandemic. Still time for you to join in if you have a question or thought at 800-642-1234. Peter, the Americans with Disabilities Act was not written and passed during a major global pandemic. Is it being stretched, tested a lot in this unusual circumstance we've seen for the last couple of years?
Well, that's another very interesting question. And I would say it's almost completely true what you said. To some extent, aspects of the Americans with Disabilities Act in its passage and the early case law was influenced by the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s. And as a matter of fact, the first case involving disability decided by the United States Supreme Court, a case called Bragdon versus Abbott, was about a woman with asymptomatic HIV disease and whether a local dentist was required to treat her in his office using universal precautions, you know, in a safe way, even though it was against his ideas about how he'd like to practice. And the United States Supreme Court ruled that the individual's rights trumped in that case, and it was discriminatory for the dentist, in this case, to fill a cavity, not to fill the cavity of this woman named Sydney Abbott because she had HIV disease and because he could have done it in a way that was safe. But they considered that an element of discrimination. So in many ways, the ADA was influenced by, wasn't a pandemic certainly, but certainly a major health crisis. And many of the early cases went to such sorts of decisions. Another case in which I was involved with before the United States Supreme Court was what they called Chevron v. Achazabal, was essentially whether or not an employer had to hire an individual who had a particular type of liver disease and might be harmed by working in that environment. In that case, the Supreme Court said they did not have to hire that person because his health condition have worsened in the environment and would have been a direct threat, so it's called, to his and others' safety in the workplace. So it's really a complex area, but the ADA certainly has not been immune to these sorts of questions prior.
And Peter, just in our last minute or so, you mentioned earlier a lot of these cases making their way through courts, into legislatures, and more. What are some of the questions you are interested in seeing courts answer over the next few months or so?
Well, I think this education question is really important for so many of us, people who have children with disabilities or health conditions, and universities, of course, and other sorts. But so how do we balance the obvious protection for health and safety with our individual rights, our fundamental rights to speak freely? Some people say wearing a mask shows a political form of speech, you know, forces a political form of speech, that you are basically speaking as the government would like you to speak. Can you argue with that in good conscience when it's brought, you know, by reasonable people? And that's what makes these cases so complex. It transcends health, and it goes to essentially how we view the nature of our rights in a republic, and to what extent can those rights be compromised or changed as a result of this unprecedented health emergency. And we're just going to have to wait and see how the courts, almost on a daily basis, are grappling with these sorts of questions. And it's unlikely then that we'll see one sort of national ruling or order, given the complexity and the variations among the states and districts, businesses, and so forth.
Peter, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, and I look forward to hearing more about your views on this issue.
That's Peter Blank, university professor and chair of the Burton Blatt Institute at the Syracuse University College of Law. He joined us for a look at the Americans with Disabilities Act and how it applies to pandemic protections. Still time to share your thoughts on these issues over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.